the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
And I'm Charlie McCarron.
And today we're kicking off our set collection series with Splendor. Now, if you're not familiar with Splendor, it's a pretty simple game. Effectively, you're trying to gather some chips that have different types of gems on them, and you're going to use those gems to buy mines that produce gems for you. And so basically, on your turn, you'll either choose three different gems, two of the same gem, or a wild gem, and a card of your choice, a mine of your choice. And you'll reserve that one, but we can get into that. And you're going to just go around one at a time. And it's a very quick game. So you'll be choosing, you know, one of those options. You can also, once you have enough gems, buy a mine. And that mine will produce gems on each of your turns. It doesn't give you a token, but it does count as a token if you were to buy something. There's three tiers of cards. The first tier doesn't really give you points, but it does give you the gems that are permanent. The second tier can give you points, but they're normally pretty small and a lot more costly. And then the third tier gives you a lot of points. Now, why is this game set collection? Well, you're trying to collect these different things, which is one thing, but they also have these noble cards, where as you collect mines of certain types, those nobles will visit you and you will get to score those nobles. And so that's kind of how we tied in set collection for this game. Also, I really wanted to do Splendor, so
yeah,
here we are. I did want to do a part of engine building, but then there were other things we also wanted to do, so
yep,
here we are.
Yeah, it's a great game. I enjoy it every time, and even though it's so simple, and normally I'm not like that big a fan of like recipe collection type things, but for some reason it's just very satisfying. Like the limit of your what actions you can do is a small amount, but it gets really tense when you start.
Yeah,
we played twice, and the second game even more tense once all three of us were really paying attention to what we were going for.
Yeah,
and I think actually it's a good example of why set collection is so fun, is because the nobles especially, we knew what we were each going for, and we could look around the table and see like,
where everyone was.
Trevor's
at
one away from getting this.
We were all
I'm one away from getting this. And then Ananda's one away.
And then Ananda got it.
Yeah. And if we didn't say this, the game ends as soon as someone gets 15 points.
Right.
So there's that race to points. Rather than like a lot of games, we'll just go for a certain amount of rounds. I guess, you do play an equal number of turns.
Right, you do finish out the round after the last person. That person gets 15 points. But if it's the last person of that round, it's just over.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed it. One of the interesting things about it is the three different tiers of mine all give the same number of gems. So there is a tension between, okay, well, I can build up my mines much faster if I get the lowest tier, but then I'm not participating in the victory point race. I mean, theoretically, I might do better later. That was the first game we played. I had a ton of mines, but then Charlie ended the game before I could use them.
I think Charlie ended the game after his like sixth or seventh mine purchase. I'm like, what? Well, how did you do that?
Things are working out real well for the rubies and obsidian
and chocolates.
Chocolate.
but that decision to have the mines all produce the same amount does really create an interesting choice between trying to, you know, build out your engine.
Then you're also trying to judge, like, well, how many points do I get per token that I spend? And it's not necessarily like, oh, man, that cost, you know, five blue. You have three blue mines, you know, that's fine. Like, you're able to easily do that. So it really only cost you two chips. And so, like, you're trying to do all this kind of clever math while you're still in pursuit of your goal. And the other thing I thought was interesting is that, you know, I don't think there is a prescribed balance of, like, these gems build this kind of mine. Other than oftentimes if you have the same color, like a lot of the same color, it will be to that type of mine. But I even saw it true with, like, you have five reds and you get a white mine. So it's really interesting kind of how that's all split up and divvied up. You can't really, like, focus on one too much.
Yeah, you don't, it's not like, you're right, you're not getting the colors based on the type of mine that they're going to produce.
Right.
Well, I would say that the main thing you're deciding which mine to get is which nobles are out.
Right. That's a big, big piece of the puzzle. Or if there's a big, like, high point card out there that needs, like, seven blue, you might try to just get seven blue in front of you so that you can get that a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in terms of set collection games and what makes a game a set collection game versus other things, we went through our entire list of... set games we've done on the show.
And now we're going, like, to read that to you. One second. Yeah.
I thought we would have way more that we would count as set collecting games because there are a lot of
them. It's such a common mechanic, yeah.
But in doing so, we decided a good definition of set collecting is that you have to have a set to do a certain thing.
Right,
like,
right.
There's a lot of games where you can find synergies and combos with, like, if, like, in Monte Carlo, for example, if you build up, you know, a few in the same column, then that's helpful. But we decided, that, and again, why I think set collection works so well in games is because it gives players a goal that is easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, get these three things or whatever. And yeah, it's like you can have small goals, which is like, I just need two things to do this. Or you can have like long-term goals, which in this case is the nobles cards, where it's like, well, this first stage goal is easy. Just get a few gems to get a mine card. Then the next stage is the same concept, but just it'll take longer.
Right, yeah. Right. And you're also trying to weigh, like, some might cost a lot of gems to buy it, but if you've built up your engine enough or your purchasing power enough, then it's pretty cheap. And so being able to kind of also play the probabilities a little bit too can be a part of the game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're trying to, like, okay, well, I want to be ready for this kind of set to come out so that I can get that when it's time. But, like, I heavily invested in blue in our first game, and very few high blue cost cards came out. So it was not a good move, and I could have probably planned that a little bit better.
And of course, this was one of the things I noticed. It has a market, which means you have the usual market dynamic of buying things from the market can be risky because the next card might be something that somebody else can get that's really good for them.
When we're all climbing over each other for that last white card, and we just all have two white, and we're right there.
There were times in that game I passed up free cards because I didn't want to...
give it to Charlie.
Yeah, to swap out the market.
Yep.
That's a good example of how the game arc is interesting because, you're not doing the same thing every turn throughout the game because once you have the power, you're giving up these things that you, in the beginning, worked so hard to get.
Right.
And then it's like, well, I don't even want to spend my time on that. Mm-hmm. Paltry little 0 point mine.
Right. Time becomes more valuable than resources.
Right.
Yeah.
In the late game.
Those actions. Mm.
Yes. The permanent building up of your income feels very good in this game, I think. Permanent resources are always quite nice.
It does feel very good.
Yeah. That's a very solid source of progression. And in this game, they're very easy to understand because it's the exact same thing. You have the temporary gem chips, which are reflected in the permanent gem mines.
Right. And the gem chips are spent. I don't think I actually said that. And you're limited to having 10 in front of you at a time.
Right.
So even though you're drawing maybe 3 per turn, once you have 10 in front of you, you have to start discarding them. And what I really love about this pressure, too, is that in a 3-player game, there's 25 chips out there that are non-wild. And so we can't all just be sitting on 10 chips. We have to have that pressure or we won't have an actual, like, market or economy. We kind of tank the ruby market because someone's just hoarding all the rubies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In our first game, we didn't interact with the wild chips.
Yeah.
And then we did in the second game. And so one thing about wild cards is, I guess, in set collection games in general, wild cards are kind of a problem because being able to use... So when I say a wild card, I mean...
the chip.
I mean something that can be used as any of the things you need to finish a set.
Sure, sure.
It's wild.
Right.
And this is a problem because the challenge of set collection games is, you know,
Collecting the set. Yeah.
And wild cards give you a lot of flexibility. And flexibility is contrary to strategic thinking. If you're flexible enough, you don't need to have a strategy. You can just rely on the flexibility. If you have all wild cards, then you can do whatever you want, and there's not much of a game. And I think set collection games in general find some way to balance out wild cards, but sometimes it doesn't feel as good as other times. Like one example I always think of is in Ticket to Ride, the Rainbow Locomotives are cards which they're wild cards, but you can draw them randomly, or you can take one from the market, and if you take one from the market, that's the only card you take instead of taking two.
Right.
But then the market gets clogged up with these trains that no one will take, and so they have to have a special rule for clearing the market when there are too many. And I think that is not as good of a way of handling it as what happens in this game, which is that you only it's a similar thing where if you take the wild card in this game, you only get one chip instead of two or three. And of course, having more chips is better, right?
Yeah.
Taking three different chips is usually better than two unless you're looking for something specific, because it means you're going to have more options for buying things in the future.
Right.
But you might really want to. And if you take just one, that seems very bad because it's like one third
the power.
Yes. But in addition to the benefit of it being wild, you also get to reserve a card.
Right.
And the reason I think this is very good is if it was just, okay, you can take one wild card, you would pretty much never do that. Because clearly three is better than one, and even two is probably better than one, even if the one is flexible. But the value of reserving a card is uncertain. You're like it's hard to translate a card reservation into a chip value. Cost.
Yeah, chip value. Yeah.
So when you take the wild card, it feels more like you haven't wasted your turn. In the same way that if you're playing Ticket to Ride and you take the wild card, it kind of feels like you wasted your turn because you only got
one train.
Yeah, you only got one train.
Yeah.
You'd usually rather just draw two blindly from the top of the deck than do that.
Well,
and I think maybe this might be my takeaway, which is okay. In set collection games, generally you want wild cards to be harder to get than other things, so you're going to get fewer of them than other things as a way to balance them. And in order to make it seem less bad, you should pair the wild card with some other thing which is of uncertain value so that you still feel good about taking it.
Sure.
That is my takeaway.
You decrease that power, that purchasing power from the one wild, but then you have an extra little benefit that's hard to really figure out what that is worth.
Because
you also reveal a new card that you won't have access to until your next turn. So like technically revealing a new card is good for everyone else.
Yes.
And you the least.
Right. So yeah, let players take one wild card instead of however many other normal cards, but pair it with something that feels good but of uncertain value.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think my takeaway is related to the nobles tiles, because I was thinking about this just now, how much less fun this game would be without those in the game.
Yeah.
Because without those, you wouldn't have like a higher level strategy or a later game goal other than getting points.
Yeah.
And I think as a designer, I strive to not just make things that, I'm trying to get points. Like I do these things to get points, do this to get points. It's kind of a dead end. Whereas there's not many dead ends in this game other than, because by the time you get to that stage, the game's probably almost over.
Mm-hmm,
right.
So you're kept engaged the whole time and feeling like you're making progress in more ways than just getting points. And I think that's just my takeaway from set collecting in general. If you have the option to give players points versus a cool thing that's a resource, or even if it's basically points, it's like feels better if it's a thing thematically. And the fact that now that I have this thing, I really need this other thing.
Sure.
there's not an equivalent if you're just giving people VP to that feeling.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that was very similar to what I was originally going to say too. Just because I love the kind of meta you enter into with, you know, you're vying for these mind cards. You're trying to get these just so you can get other cards that might give you points or give you different access to different resources. But then there's always this other conversation happening of, well, who's going to get these nobles? And in the first game we played, we didn't get a single noble card. We were going
right, for I was going
Charlie
for
ended
it,
it too
it,
fast.
Yeah, it got too big of
Charlie
a
somehow
card
got 15 points really fast.
Then, yeah, actually, so I think another thing that just worked out weirdly in our game but made it more fun is that there was a different hierarchy of valuation of these five colors.
Yeah.
Because in the regularly, if you just randomly dealt this out, they are equal in a way. But because, like, for example, in our second game, every noble needed blue, mm-hmm. suddenly we cared a ton about blue.
Yeah.
And also, there was almost no blue out on the board.
High demand,
that
low
was
supply.
Super yeah. fun.
Raises the price.
Yes. Yeah. And, yeah. And in fact, that makes me think if there was going to be a Splendor 2, I would build in different valuation of the, rather than just being totally
equal
in rarity, like build in rarity into it, your game.
Oh, so just have so that, like,
yeah.
there are more of this color, like yep. maybe the fewest of diamonds because diamonds
yeah.
are the rarest,
yeah.
but then you have like more of sapphire and emeralds or
yeah.
rubies.
And maybe there's the most common symbol also has some other benefit to it or something like that.
Oh, sure.
Whereas the rarest one is mostly, it's very valuable to get, but it just gets you points or something. So,
well, and you could even yeah. have it be where, you know, doing the simplest one can build out your action economy.
Sure.
But it doesn't give you any points.
Yeah.
So you could be vying for this thing that never actually produces what you need it to unless you get it early enough.
Yeah.
And then it like, that could be fun.
They could have built it, and maybe there is a little bit of that we just don't see under the hood, but
sure.
I think they probably tried to make them balanced. But like, I could imagine like tier one deck has more of one resource, and then as you go up, it's like more
yeah. fancy resources.
The drawback to doing that is now you really should be explicit in the rule book about like, this is more rare than this.
You need players to know what to expect when they're yeah. going
like if
in.
They were beans and you had more beans and then oh sorry.
Oh yeah. We'll get there. We'll get there. Oh, that's a good point. Okay.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the nobles I think are so effective in creating a goal for players is that in games with threshold costs, overlapping thresholds, I feel, are very satisfying to achieve. So, like, all of the nobles want blue.
Yeah.
So, if you have enough blue, that's paying multiple costs with the same actions.
Right. Now you just need white. And then right. you can get two other cards, where there's blue and white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It gives players... I really like for players to feel that they have a way that they can outperform the game. You know, there are some games where an action will always give you more or less the same value. And I think it's a lot more fun when an action can give you dramatically different amounts of value depending on how clever you are about
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
And threshold game or games with threshold-based costs have that built in. Now, this one's interesting because it's sort of a mixed cost because part of the threshold is met automatically by your mines, mm-hmm. but then another part of it you're spending consumable resources. So it's sort of... kind of a hybrid, but like I guess another example would be Spirit Island with the elemental thresholds, where if you can it feels really satisfying to meet the thresholds for multiple abilities using the same elements.
Yeah.
And I think that's common with all threshold costs, and that's like one advantage of using thresholds as a cost.
Sure Yeah. I honestly, in games like this, especially competitive games, having it be where it is a threshold you're trying to get to first, instead of it being just an end game scoring thing where if you have four of these at the end of the game, then you get the points automatically. Like, having that race in there really drives up the tension too, which feels mm-hmm. really nice. Especially for a game that's a little bit simpler on the mechanics. Now you're actually competing and actually trying to vie for this thing. and you're maybe taking, you know, that gold so you can reserve a card so that someone can't get it, even though you can't afford it. So it's a little bit more cutthroat at that point.
Well, and the other interesting thing, there's no, it is a card game, but there's no secret information other than like what gets randomly drawn for the board. So
other than what none of us know.
Yeah. So it's pretty satisfying to be able to look around and actually see what people can get at any given time. And you can plan ahead. And like, there's times even when I was like, well, Trevor's doing this thing. Ananda has already reserved 3 cards, so he can't reserve anymore. I'm locked in. I can get this card. or it's like, yeah, the risk of, well, it's better to wait for another turn. I'll just collect more chips because I don't think either of you guys will reserve this card or buy it. Mm-hmm. But
it, I mean, that's like the core of interaction, right? Predicting what other players will do and reacting to what you think they're going to do.
And so I've been holding off also saying my takeaway because I had to find a new one while we were talking. So that's always fun. I think I'm going to make it a little bit simpler, and it's going to be based around the action economy and having it so simple that, you know, this one is, you know, you can choose 3 different, 2 of the same, or a wild and a card to reserve. That very simple, like, okay, obviously 3 every time is really good. So there's always like that first, like, I want 3 is better than 2. Everything needs at least 3 that are out there. So yeah, that's obviously the better thing. But what if there's one on the next turn that requires 2 of 1 that you don't have yet? Mm-hmm. Now you can just pick 2 of that one and you are ready for the next turn. And it feels really nice having that choice because the gems themselves kind of get worth more the more that are requested of them in a single card. So the higher that requirement is, the more value is placed on it. And I think that's a really cool system. So yeah, I like the 3-2-1 is my favorite part of like, or the thing I want to take away is like just that very simple choice for getting those resources for set collection.
Yeah. I also thought that was a very clean way to divide up the actions.
Yeah.
And it kind of has a mnemonic built in because 3-2-1.
Yep.
It reminds me a little bit of, I guess, slightly different mnemonic, but in Dominion there's ABC, right? Action.
Oh, sure.
What is it? Action by cleanup.
Sure. I forgot that was how it was
said. I think it's great when games structure their turns in a way that
it's easy to remember.
It feels very symmetrical isn't the right word. It feels very
natural or organic.
Natural, clean,
intuitive.
I don't know if intuitive is the right, like aesthetically pleasing.
Sure.
The turn structure itself is aesthetically pleasing. The different parts of it, I guess it's sort of like symmetry.
Yeah,
like the golden ratio.
Yeah,
that kind of that
sure.
Kind of
yeah, thing, something yeah. like that.
Sure.
Yeah, 3-2-1.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they didn't need reference cards for the game either.
No,
that would be.
I did have to remind us a couple times on a couple of the weird things, like, you know, you can't take 2 if there's less than 4 in a stack.
Yeah, that rule is
stuff like
kind of weird.
It's like a little bit of outlier things. And
yep.
Yeah.
Not really sure why that rule's in there.
So you can't double down on a gem, I think.
Yeah, and I think that may have helped me in a minor way because I did cheat at least once. I forgot about that rule. I did too.
Yeah.
In that first game where I was able to get a bunch of the same color.
Mm-hmm. And that might be why.
To get a big point thing.
Yeah, get those 7s or 5s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if that rule's necessary. It seems more trouble than it's worth to me.
It might balance the game more.
They probably had some playtesters who were like, every time.
He shouldn't be able to do that.
Catering to the angry playtesters. That's what we have to do as game
designers.
Next
up on rules and rants.
Yeah, that's like a slight blemish in the turn structure.
Oh, yes. The slight blemish. The asterisk.
Have you played the Marvel Splendor?
I haven't played it yet.
I haven't either, but I was curious to see what they did with the Infinity Gauntlet.
Oh, sure.
There was like some other... Anyways, there's more... A little more to it that sounded interesting, but... So far, I don't know that they've done expansions. They did Splendor Duel, which is very different.
And there is an expansion, the Cities expansion.
Oh,
something
okay.
like that. I don't remember. Well, that was a while ago, so I might be yeah. completely wrong. So
that's already
you can yell at me in the Discord if I'm wrong about that. Go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for you.
Already a pretty perfect game. I'm glad we did it for the podcast. Yeah, that's Splendor.
Splendorific.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com, where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.